Mark chapter 5, 21 through 24, and 35 to 43. I'm reading out of the NIV. When Jesus had crossed again over by boat to the other side of the lake, a large crowd gathered around him while he was by the lake. Then one of the synagogue leaders named Jairus came, and when he saw Jesus, he fell at his feet. He pleaded earnestly with him, "My little daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and live." So Jesus went with him. A large crowd followed and pressed against him. And while Jesus was still speaking, some people came from the house of Jairus, the synagogue leader. "Your daughter is dead," they said. "Why bother the teacher anymore?" Overhearing what they said, Jesus told him, "Don't be afraid, just believe." He did not let anyone follow him except Peter, James, and John, the brother of James. And when they came to the home of the synagogue leader, Jesus saw a commotion with people crying and wailing loudly. He went in and said to them, "Why all this commotion and wailing? The child is not dead, but asleep." But they laughed at him. After he put them all out, he took the child's father and mother and the disciples who were with him and went into where the child was. And he took her by the hand and said to her, "Talitha kum," which means, "Little girl, I say to you, get up." Immediately the girl stood up and began to walk around. She was 12 years old, and at this they were completely astonished. He gave strict orders not to tell anyone about this, and told them to give her something to eat. When Max Lucado's daughters were young, he tried an experiment. He recalls, "I asked Jenna, then 8 years old, to go to one side of the room. I had Andrea, 6, stand on the other side of the den. 3-year-old Sarah and I sat on the couch in the middle, and they watched. Jenna's job was to close her eyes and walk. Andrea's job was to be Jenna's eyes and talk her safely across the room." With phrases like, "Take 2 baby steps to the left," "Take 4 giant steps forward," Andrea successfully navigated her little sister through a treacherous maze of chairs, a vacuum cleaner, and a laundry basket. And then Jenna took her turn. She guided Andrea past her mom's favorite lamp and shouted just in time to keep her from colliding into a wall when she thought her right foot was her left foot. Well, after several treks through the darkness, they stopped and we processed. "I didn't like it," Jenna complained. "It's scary going where you can't see." "I was afraid I was going to fall," Andrea said. "I was taking little steps just to be safe." I can relate. Can you? We grown-ups, we don't like the dark either, but we walk in it. We, like Jenna, often complain about how scary it is to walk where we can't see. And we, like Andrea, often take timid steps so we won't fall. We've reason to be cautious because we're blind to the future. It's one limitation we all share. The wealthy are just as blind as the poor. The educated are just as sightless as the unschooled. And the famous know as little about the future as the unknown. None of us knows how our children will turn out. None of us knows the day we will die. No one knows whom he or she will marry, or even if marriage lies before him or her. We are universally, absolutely blind. We are all Jenna with her eyes shut, groping through a dark room, listening for a familiar voice. But there is a difference. Her surroundings are familiar and friendly. Ours can be hostile and fatal. Her worst fear was a stubbed toe, Our worst fear is far more threatening: cancer, divorce, loneliness, death. And try as we might to walk as straight as we can, chances are our toe is going to get stubbed and we're going to get hurt. Just ask Jairus. He was a man who tried to walk as straight as he can. But Jairus is a man whose path has taken a sudden turn into a dark cave, and he doesn't want to enter it alone. Jairus is the leader of the synagogue. That may not mean that much to you and me, but in the days of Christ, the leader of the synagogue was the most important man in the community. The synagogue was the center of religious and social and education, all kinds of activity. And the leader of the synagogue was the senior religious leader, the highest ranking professor, the mayor, the best known citizen all of town. And Jairus has it all. I mean, he has job security, a guaranteed welcome at the coffee shop, a pension plan, golf every Thursday, and an annual all-expense-paid trip to the national convention. Who could ask for more? Well, Jairus does. In fact, he'd trade the whole package of perks and privileges for just one assurance: that his daughter would live. The Jairus we see in this story is not the clear-sighted, black-frocked, nicely groomed civic leader. He is instead a blind man begging for a gift. He fell at Jesus' feet, saying again and again, "My daughter is dying. Please come and put your hands on her so that she will be healed and will live." He doesn't barter with Jesus. He just pleads. There are times in life when everything you have to offer is nothing compared to what you are asking to receive. Jairus is such a point. What could a man offer in exchange for his child's life? So there are no games, no haggling, no masquerades. The situation is starkly simple. Jairus is blind to the future, but Jesus knows the future. So Jairus asks for his help. And Jesus, who loves the honest heart, goes to give it. And God, who knows what it's like to lose a child, empowers his son. Warren Wiersbe: it wasn't easy for Jairus to come to Jesus publicly and ask for his help. The religious leaders who were opposed to Jesus would certainly not approve, nor would some of the other synagogue leaders, for the things that Jesus has done and said made the scribes and Pharisees angry, some of whom were probably Jairus' friends. But Jairus was desperate. So many people are when they come to Jesus. And at this point, he'd rather lose his friends. But before Jesus and Jairus get very far, they're interrupted by emissaries from Jairus' house. "Your daughter is dead. There's no need to bother the teacher anymore." Well, get ready. Hang on. Here's where the story gets moving. Jesus goes from being led to leading, from being convinced by Jairus to convincing Jairus, from being admired to being laughed at, from helping out to people to casting out the people. Here is where Jesus takes control. Verse 36. "But Jesus paid no attention to what they said." Great line. It describes a critical principle for seeing the unseen. Sometimes we have to ignore what people say. We have to black them out, turn them off, close your ears. If you must, even walk away. Turn a deaf ear toward those who say you aren't smart enough or fast enough or tall enough or big enough. Ignore them. Disregard those who say you'll never amount to anything. Ignore the ones who say it's too late to start over. Faith sometimes begins by stuffing your ears with cotton. Jesus turns immediately to Jairus and pleads, "Don't be afraid. Just believe." The Jesus Bible comments on this passage in this way. Faith is different from feelings. Feelings are based on circumstances, and that changes like the weather. Faith involves acting, trusting, and believing that God is real, at work, and working on believers for believers' good, regardless of what one may happen to feel at the moment. In fact, sometimes faith leads believers in the opposite direction of feeling. God invites people to faithfully trust Him for all of life. As you know, my life's verses are Proverbs 3, 5, and 6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Lean not unto your own understanding. In all thy ways acknowledge Him, and He shall direct thy paths. The way of Jesus is the way of trust. And all throughout His life on earth, Jesus demonstrated absolute faith in His Father. He challenged His followers to exercise the same kind of faith. You know, for many reasons, people are just prone to doubt. Modern Western culture is fraught with skepticism. The contemporary search for truth says, understand in order to believe. And against this thinking, Jesus has always maintained, believe in order to understand. In the struggle with doubt and unbelief, Jesus encourages people, don't be afraid, just believe. The way of Jesus is trusting God every day for this life and for the next. So Jesus compels Jairus to see the unseen, and when Jesus says, just believe, He's imploring, don't limit your possibilities to the visible. Don't listen just for the audible. Don't be controlled by the logical. Believe there is far more to life than meets the eye. Trust me, Jesus is pleading. Just trust. As Paul wrote in 2 Corinthians 4:18, we set our eyes not on what we see, but on what we cannot see. What we see lasts only for a short time, but what we cannot see will last forever. So Jesus is asking Jairus to see the unseen, to make a choice, either to live by the facts or see by faith. And when tragedy strikes us, we too are left to choose what we see. We can see the hurt, or we can see the healer. The choice is ours. And Jairus makes his choice. He opted for faith and for Jesus. Though, as Warren Wiersbe points out, it was easier for Jairus to trust the Lord while his daughter was still living and while Jesus was still walking with him to the house. But when Jesus stopped to heal the woman and when friends came to tell him the bad news, Jairus just about lost his faith. But let's not be too hard on him. We've probably given way to doubt when circumstances and feelings just overwhelm us. Sometimes God has delayed, and we've wondered why. That's when we need that special word of faith from the Lord, and we receive it as we spend time in His Word. Well, at the house, Jesus and Jairus encounters a group of mourners, and Jesus is troubled by their wailing. It bothers Him that they express such anxiety over death. Why are you still crying and making so much noise? The child is not dead, only asleep. That's not a rhetorical question. It's an honest one. For from his perspective, that child is still alive, only is just asleep. And from God's viewpoint, death is not permanent. It's a necessary step from passing from this world to the next. It's not an end, it's a beginning. On Johnny and Diana's tombstone down in the cemetery, are these words, "Death is not the end of our story, but it's only its eternal beginning." With friends, as Mark mentioned in Sunday school this morning, that we recently watched the animated version of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, where Christian had to go through the Valley of the Shadow, taking a plunge through a watery vale to reach the other side, to reach the celestial city, to experience death so that he could be made alive. From his book, They Walked With God, Max Lucado illustrates, "As a young boy, I had two great loves, playing and eating. Mom, summers were made for afternoons on the baseball diamond and meals at Mom's dinner table. But Mom had a rule, however. Dirty, sweaty boys couldn't eat at the table. And her first words to us as we came in were, 'Go clean up, change those clothes if you want to eat.' Now, no boy is fond of bathing and dressing, but I never once complained because I never defied my mom by saying, 'Well, I'd rather stink than eat.' In my economy, a bath and a clean shirt were a small price to pay for a good meal. And from God's perspective, death is a small price to pay for the privilege of sitting at his table. 1 Corinthians 15:50, flesh and blood cannot be a part of the kingdom of God. This body that can be destroyed must clothe itself with something that can never be destroyed. And this body that dies must clothe itself with something that can never die." So God's even more insistent than Max's mom was. For in order to sit at his table, a change of clothing must occur. We must put on his robe of righteousness. Death is not to be dreaded. It is to be welcomed. And so when he sees people in crying mourning over death, he wants to know, "Why are you crying?" Often when we see death, we see disaster. When Jesus sees death, he sees deliverance. In this story, that's too much for the people to take, and they laughed at him. Now, look closely. I had to reread this because I didn't hardly believe what Jesus does next. He throws the mourners out. That's what the text says. After throwing them out of the house, he doesn't just ask them to leave. He throws them out. He jerks them up by the collar and sets them sailing. Jesus' response is decisive and strong. And in the original text, the word used here is the same word used to describe what Jesus did to the money changers in the temple. It's the same verb used 38 times to describe what Jesus did to the demons. Wow, such force, such intolerance. Max says, "Perhaps the answer is found in going back to my family's living room experience. After Jenna and Andrea had taken turns guiding each other through the den, I decided to add a little diabolical twist. On the last trip, I snuck up behind Jenna, who was walking with her eyes shut, and began whispering, 'Don't listen to her. Listen to me. I'll take care of you.' Jenna stopped. She analyzed the situation, and then she made her choice between the two voices. 'Be quiet, Daddy,' she giggled, and then she continued in Andrea's direction. Undeterred, I grabbed the lid of a pan and held it near her ear and banged it with a spoon, and she jumped and stopped, startled by the noise. Andrea, seeing that her pilgrim was frightened, did a great thing. She ran across the room, threw her arms around her sister, and said, 'Don't worry, I'm right here.' She wasn't about to let the noise distract Jenna from the journey. And God isn't going to let the noise distract you from yours. He's still busy casting out the critics, silencing the voices that can deter you. Some of his work you have seen. Most of it you haven't. And only when you get home will you know how many times he has protected you from luring voices. Only eternity will reveal how he interfered with the job transfer, protecting you from involvement with a shady business. Fogged in the airport, distancing you from an unethical opportunity. Flattened your tire, prevented you from checking into the hotel and meeting a seductive man. Only in heaven will show the times he protected you by giving you a mate who loves God more than you do. Opening the door to a new business so you could attend the same church together. Having the right voice with the right message on the right radio station the day you needed his encouragement. Mark it down. God knows that you and I are blind. He knows living by faith and not by sight doesn't come naturally. We need God's GPS. And I think that's one reason he raised Jairus' daughter. Not for her sake. She was better off being in heaven. But for our sake, to teach us that heaven sees when you and I trust and believe. Verse 41, Jesus took her by the hand and said to her, Talitha kumi. I was intrigued with that phrase, and I found J. Vernon McGee's thoughts in Through the Bible most interesting. Talitha kumi was an expression of the Aramaic that the little girl would have understood, for it was in her native tongue and could be translated, little lamb, wake up. That's what he said to her. And that's a sweet, lovely thing. We find that our Lord raised the little girl. He raised a man in the vigor of young manhood, the widow's son at Nain. And then even a senior citizen, Lazarus. He raised them all the same way he spoke to them. And I think this little girl represents the little folks, those little ones before they reach the age of accountability. And he said to her in this lovely way, little lamb, wake up. I know right now I'm speaking to a lot of folk who have lost little ones. And when we lost our first little one, what a sad thing it was for us. And it's wonderful for me to know that although she's been in his presence for many years, one of these days he's going to speak those words again. Little lamb, wake up. He'll be talking to my little lamb and to your little lamb. That little form that we laid away will be raised from the grave, the spirit joined to the glorified body, and we will again have our little one someday. What a wonderful, beautiful thing this is. It's a demonstration of his power and his love. Max again. I saw it last week as I spoke at a funeral. The widower, a wrinkled-faced man with white hair and bifocals, he didn't weep like the others. In fact, at one point, I think I saw him smile. I shook his hand afterwards. Don't worry about me, he exclaimed. And then he motioned for me to lean down so he could say something in my ear. I know where she is. I saw it in the eyes of the cancer patient I visited yesterday, bald from chemotherapy, shadowed eyes from the disease. Her skin was soft, her hand bony. She recognized me when she awoke, and she didn't even say hello. She just lofted her eyebrows, sparkled that sparkle, and said, I'm ready, Max. I'm ready to go. Peace where there should be pain. Confidence in the midst of crisis. hope defying despair? That's what the look says. It's a face of grace. It's a look that knows the answer to the questions asked by every mortal. Does death have the last word? I can see Jesus wink as he gives the answer. Not in your life. Jesus ministered to some of the most important people and some of the most despised people in town. His power surpassed demons and sickness and death. And although Jesus brought life to those who were physically dead, he spent most of his energy reaching those who were spiritually dead. He wanted to give them a new spiritual life. In Mark 5, the funeral had begun. The people thought the best Jesus could do was offer some kind words about Jairus' girl. Jesus had some words, all right, not about the girl, but to the girl. My child, stand up. And the next thing we know, she was eating. Jesus was laughing. The hired mourners were sent home early. He'll do it again, you know. He promised that he would. And he's shown that he can. 1 Thessalonians 4:16, the Lord himself will come down from heaven and with a loud command. And the same voice that awoke the boy near Nain, that stirred the still daughter of Jairus, that awakened the corpse of Lazarus, the same voice will speak again, and the earth and the sea will give up their dead. There will be no more death. Jesus made sure of that. Selah.